Should karma be viewed as belief or instruction? What would it be like to live without a belief system? How do you make practice your own? Hello, I'm Ken MacLeod. This 11-part series was recorded during a retreat that focused on karma, interdependency, and working with patterns. We begin by discussing meditation as a capacity for attention. Here is part one of Awakening from Belief.
Pleasure to be here, finally. The misadventures in Chicago were a wonderful example of the cost of efficiency. Everybody was on the plane. We were taxiing towards the runway. They put us into a holding zone, did a quick calculation, and found out there wasn't enough gas in the plane. Weather systems had caused a reroute, and they hadn't anticipated that, so that was everybody was very well behaved, though. Well, the subject matter for our work together over the next few days, we called it Awakening from Belief. And it's really about karma. Now, karma is one of those big Eastern concepts around which there is actually a great deal of great variety of interpretation. It means a lot of different things. And there's also a great deal of confusion. One way, perhaps, into the subject of karma. How many of you are familiar with Mullah Nasruddin? Ah, good. He's one of the great Buddhist teachers. Well, Mullah Nasruddin was walking home one night, and he saw some people on horseback. And he thought they might be thieves, so he started to run, and he ran as fast as he could, and turned around, and he saw that the people on horseback were riding after him. So he ran faster and faster, and he came across a cemetery and ran into the cemetery and looked desperately for a place to hide, and found an open grave and jumped to the bottom of it and lay at the bottom of the grave. Well, the people on horseback, what they'd seen was that this person who'd suddenly started to run and thought something must be wrong. So they'd started going after to see who it was. And they eventually tracked him down and peered over the grave and looked down at Mullah Nasruddin and said, what are you doing there? And Nasruddin looked up and said, well, just because you can ask a question doesn't mean there's a straightforward answer. But, in short, I'm here because of you, and you're here because of me. Well, this very nicely illustrates interdependence. And that's one of the central aspects of karma. One of the central tenets, and I hesitate to say tenet, but be more accurate to say things one comes to understand through practice, is that nothing exists in its own right. Everything is interdependent, which is very different to from saying that everything is relative. It's not the same thing at all. We may talk about that more later. Now, we're very happy to go along with that idea, that everything is interdependent, until it comes to one small aspect of our experience, the sense of self. And at that point, we hit the brakes and say, what do you mean? I'm here. How can you say? But is that true? So, when Newcomb and I were discussing this program, Newcomb came up with the formulation, awakening from the belief in an independent self. And we just shortened it to awakening from belief. But that's one of the central beliefs that we have, is that we exist independently. Well, if we don't exist independently, then it raises a number of questions. The first question might be, well, do we exist dependently? And if so, what does that mean? And that feels really uncomfortable, that somehow our existence is dependent on something else. But actually, it invites another question. Do we exist? How many say you do? How many say you don't? So there's a conundrum here, isn't there? So, this is what we're going to explore. That's one thing we're going to explore. Another thing, which I think is very important, and the reason, one of the reasons I wanted to put the emphasis on belief. One of my teachers is a Sakya Lama by the name of Dajung Rinpoche. And in the great spirit of interdependence, the reason that he was one of my teachers was thanks to the CIA. Soon after the Tibetan diaspora, the CIA brought over a number of Tibetans to act as resources to the Melvin Goldstein at the University of Seattle, that's where he was, or University of Washington, Seattle. And among these was Dajung Rinpoche. They compiled this Tibetan English dictionary, which was really intended to train CIA operatives. They gave him a nice house and everything like that. And then Kala Rinpoche set up a center in Vancouver in the early 70s and discovered that Dajung Rinpoche just lived about 100 miles away. Invited him up. And a wonderful person. One of the last really great scholars. Unlike some of the older scholars further back in Tibetan history who had actually memorized the Kanjur and they could knew the whole 108 volumes of it by heart, if you can imagine. Dajung Rinpoche wasn't quite in that category, but if you gave him a verse or a quotation, he would probably say, well, I think that's in that book, or maybe that one. And if you ever asked him a question, be prepared for a two-hour answer. I mean, you just ask him anything, he'd just go on and on and on. And then finally he'd sort of look and say, I talk too much, don't I? very difficult on translators. I translated it for him, and he just go, oh, please stop. Couldn't do anything. But Dajun Rinpoche one day told me that he was walking with his teacher, and this is in Tibet. His teacher was an individual by the name of Ngawang Lekpa. And Dajun Rinpoche was a young tukul. Ngawang Lekpa said to him, Dajun Tukula, you believe in karma? Dajun Rinpoche said, well, yes. Ngawang Lekpa said, you're really lucky. I find it really difficult. Dajun Rinpoche, this was his teacher. Well, I think one of the big sources of confusion around karma is that for some people it is a belief. And what gets into all kinds of problems when you approach it that way? And on the other hand, you have what so many teachers have said. I'm thinking of Milarepa right now, saying, you know, when you understand emptiness, then your appreciation of karma becomes very, very precise. And for a long time, I thought that it meant, well, then all kind of made sense. But over the years, I've come to appreciate it's a little different from that. There's karma as instruction, and there's karma as belief. And they're really very different. Karma as belief is susceptible to all of the problems that any belief system is susceptible to. And I think it's fair to say that Buddhism, the practice of Buddhism, is about exposing and dismantling beliefs. Karma as instruction, however, is quite wonderful. It's a little intimidating. Because when you appreciate how karma works, I'm going to say a little bit more about that this evening, realize that it's actually a gigantic injunction about mindfulness. Injunction about mindfulness. When I studied with Kala Rinpoche in India in the early 70s, Rinpoche taught us about karma, which, as you well know, is usually translated as the law of cause and effect. He would always draw a diagram of a tree. And you have a seed which grows into a shoot and grows into a tree, and it has branches, and then it has leaves, and then it has fruit, and then the whole thing starts up again. The translation as cause and effect is, I think, quite wrong, quite misleading. And I've had this discussion with a number of translators, and the first thing they do is they laugh me out of the room. I had one person said, well, if this word in Tibetan isn't cause, then this isn't a book, and he held up a book. and just thought it was the most ridiculous thing. But I want to pose a question to you. Does an acorn cause an oak tree? Is the acorn the cause of an oak tree? Well, in a certain philosophical sense, yes, but it's not how we normally use the word cause. Karma is much more a process of evolution. That's what happens with an acorn. You put it into the ground, and water soaks into it, and things start happening inside it. And after it goes through all of these changes, and roots start to go down, stuff starts to come up, and then breaks into above the ground, and then it starts getting stuff from the sun, and it evolves stage by stage into an oak tree, which then evolves into leaves and flowers, and things happen to them, and they eventually become other acorns. But in the process, the acorn isn't there. The original acorn is long since gone in this process. So the idea that actions that we do now cause things to happen in the future, which is often how people think about karma, that's not how I've come to understand it. It's that the actions that we do now are like the acorn. That's something we've done, and in doing that action, we've started a process. And that process evolves in a number of different ways. And if we have time over the next few days, I'm trying to sketch that out. But it evolves into an experienced result. It doesn't cause an experienced result. The action itself evolves into an experienced result. Because it creates conditions so that other things happen, and just goes on and on and on. So I think that when you begin to look at karma as a process of evolution, then what evolutionary processes are you starting when you get angry with your spouse? Well, is that a process you want taking place in your world of experience? Well, some of you may say yes. But I will tell you one thing, and I've had so many illustrations of this. When a process is initiated by a reaction, that is by confusion or ignorance, a reaction is always an effort to avoid experiencing something. Well, the nature of the beast is that whatever process is initiated by that effort to avoid experiencing, let's say, X, guess what that reactive process delivers? It delivers precisely X. Every time. And we'll go through some examples. But I'll just give you one which my office partner used to be a partner in a executive search firm. And he complained about the CEO, who said that, you know, he never really holds people accountable. He just wants to make nice with them about everything. And so people get away with murder and things don't get done. And he was very good at complaining, and he complained about this quite loudly. Well, when I listened to him carefully, I said, well, what's going to happen is that this firm's going to go under. Because this person is afraid of conflict, he's going to find himself, because he's afraid of being rejected by people, by being nice to everybody, he's not going to be able to move the firm where it needs to go. The firm is going to go under, and he's going to be rejected by everybody. And when the economic crunch hit, I think it was just after the, when the internet bubble burst, that's exactly what happened. And all these people that had worked very closely with this person were furious with him because the firm went bankrupt and everybody lost their health insurance, which, as you know, is a kind of a big thing in this country. But it was wonderful, in a certain sense, how it delivered precisely what he was trying to avoid. And that's just one example. I mean, I'm sure you can think of many examples from your own experience. So, what I'm talking about here is the importance of paying attention, or I should say, being aware of how we are acting and behaving, what we are actually doing in each moment. Because every moment that we're not, and every moment that we're checking out and avoiding something, we're instituting an evolutionary process which is going to deliver precisely what we tried to avoid. So you have a choice. You can either pay for it up front or you can pay for it at the end. And you know, it's a lot more expensive paying for it at the end. Pardon?
It's a compounded interest.
Oh, yeah. Thousandfold. Yeah. So, I very much appreciate you staying and indulging the eccentricities of United Airlines. But I don't want to keep this up too late tonight. We're meeting, what, at 6? 6:30? 5? 3? 2? 11?
Could we try 9 o'clock?
Oh! Well, we are doing an early morning meditation. That's not a problem. I get up that time. Pardon? Yeah, okay. We're meeting here at 9, is that right? Okay. Well, I want you to do a period of meditation in the morning anyway. Just don't have to do it together. The purpose of meditation, or one way to regard meditation, it is building a capacity of attention. I don't know whether you've had it explained that way to you before, but you're building a capacity of attention. Why is it important to have a capacity of attention? Well, arguably, a reasonable translation of the term samadhi, which I imagine some of you have heard, is attention. Now, those of you who are familiar with such esoteric teachings as the five paths and the 10 stages and all of that stuff may recall that at the end of the 10th stage, the bodhisattva enters vajra-like or diamond-like samadhi and becomes enlightened or awakened, becomes Buddha. Let's put this into English. The fundamental effort in Buddhist practice is to develop a sufficient capacity in attention so that you can experience your own non-existence. That's fine. The essence of Buddhist practice is to develop a sufficient capacity in attention so that you can experience your own non-existence. That's exactly what Buddha did under the Bodhi tree. Such relief. Don't have to be anybody. A little counterintuitive, but so all forms of meditation practice, and it doesn't matter what, they're developing attention. Sometimes they develop attention very directly, as shamatha does. Sometimes they're getting rid of the blocks in the way of developing attention, things like death and impermanence, many of the purification practices in the Vajrayana. Sometimes they're developing energy which you're going to use to power attention. Guru Yoga is an example of that. Loving kindness, compassion are examples of that. And there are also esoteric methods of developing states of attention, states of energy. But it's all about developing attention so you can actually experience what is. Taking and sending is another very good example. So, tomorrow morning, get up. We'll keep this simple. Practice for at least half an hour to an hour, depending on your schedule and ability. And you have a little gong?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Now this may seem very basic to many of you, because I know many of you have practiced for a long time, but I just like to go over these things. A lot of people think attention is an intellectual activity. It's not. Attention is emotional energy. We talked about mind in Buddhism a great deal, but the word in Sanskrit is citta, and the word in Tibetan is sem. In many cases, it would be just as appropriate, and sometimes more appropriate, to translate it as heart. So when we talk about mind, and if I use the word mind, it's really about mind and heart. It's not a division there. So it's thoughts, feelings, all of that stuff. And we use the breath as a base. Rather than focusing attention on the breath, which is how a lot of people think about practice, even, you know, don't concentrate on the breath. That's what you do to oranges. I want you to think about practice as resting in the experience of breathing. Resting in the experience of breathing. Pardon? Sorry. Resting in the experience of breathing. Okay? Now, that puts a whole different complex on it. If you're going to rest in the experience of breathing, where do you have to be? You have to be in your body. It's very difficult to rest anywhere else if you're not in your body. Because your body's doing the breathing. So you sit, and you're in the body. And the body's breathing. And you rest in that experience. Just let the body breathe naturally. Don't need any fancy tricks or anything. And so we rest in the experience of breathing. Now, what happens when you practice meditation? At least that happens to me. Maybe it doesn't happen to all of you. It happens to me all the time. we place our attention in the experience of breathing, and it falls off. Now, one of the great miracles of our being is that the mind always returns to itself. This was a verse from Saraha, who is one of the Mahamudra masters, Indian Mahamudra masters, around the 3rd or 4th century. He wrote a number of songs or dohas, and in one of them he says, this is a rough translation because I can't remember the Tibetan literally, something like that, just as a bird flying from a ship in the middle of the ocean has nowhere to return but to the ship, whatever thought arises from your mind has nowhere else to return but your own mind. So what happens is, fall off, and you go off on this whole thing, and at some point you go, oh, I'm meant to be meditating, aren't I? Oh. Now, that oh is the really important point. Oh. Oh. Just go back into the experience of breathing. So you think of meditation as placing the attention, resting, falls off, recognition happens, may happen in 30 seconds, may happen in 5 minutes, maybe it happens an hour later, I don't know. But it happens. Return attention, rest, fall off. So there's a constant sense of returning and resting. I want you to try that approach. Returning and resting, rather than trying to hold attention. Return and rest, return and rest. And this quality of resting is so important in your practice. It's where the power really develops. There's a movie called Message of the Tibetans by a Frenchman called Arnaud Desjardins. It was made in the late 60s. Very soon after the Tibetan diaspora. And it focuses on Rimtek Monastery, the seat of the Karmapa. I've only seen the film once, but the opening shot just made a very profound impression on me. It's in the main shrine hall of Rimtek Monastery, and everything's very dark, and you see some distance away a figure sitting on a throne. It's Karmapa, the 16th Karmapa. And there is this phenomenal quality of stillness. It is so still that you aren't sure whether you're looking at a movie or a slide, just a photograph. And gradually, the camera zooms in. And after quite a long time, it gets close enough that you can see that it's a movie because the lips of Karmapa are just moving ever so slightly. He's reciting a mantra. But the reason I remember it is this: there's no effort in this person. He's sitting there, totally still, at rest. So in your meditation practice, be at rest. That's how the practice deepens, is by resting deeply. It's not by pushing or by forcing. Whenever we force, we ignore. You know, if you make your, you can do this with a friend, you know, if you tense your arm and you have someone touch it and they move it a bit, it's harder to feel it. If your hand's relaxed, you feel it immediately. So this quality of resting in practice is very important. Now, the reason I'm plugging this so much is it took me 20 years to understand this. I figured I'd save you guys a couple of years anyway. It's very, very important. And every aspect of practice, cultivate that resting quality. And so you're just there. Just there. So when I say rest in the experience of breathing, I mean that. You actually just rest. You sit so that your body is straight. The spine is supported by the pelvic girdle, and the shoulders rest on the spine, and the head rests on the top of the spine. Now, sometimes it takes a while for the body to adjust to that, and some of us, I have a certain physical problem, so I have some difficulties with that, but that's the idea. And so you just rest. The body rests. The breath rests. And the mind rests. And as that quality of resting deepens, then when thoughts and sensations and feelings arise, there is no disturbance. They just arise, and they do their thing, and they let go, and that quality of resting has never changed. So this is perhaps a little different. I don't know, maybe all of you know this already. But when you sit together tomorrow morning, just try that. And we'll meet here at 9, and we can take up any questions. And I'm happy to take up a few questions now if there's anything that I've said this evening that wasn't clear. I imagine there's probably a great deal that wasn't clear. But so, I'm open. Yes?
It's Buddhism. Is it dismantling all beliefs?
Yeah.
All beliefs?
What one do you want to hang on to? Pardon? Well, can you think of a single belief that's worth hanging on to?
I just think it's a pretty outrageous statement.
Well, that's not the first time I've been called that.
I understand what you're saying, but...
What's the problem? You have an issue here. Come on, bring it up.
No, I just think it's...
What's it hitting inside you?
Well, it's the consequences of that involve all the...
What are the consequences?
Not much left.
Well, what was there in the first place?
Belief.
Yes. And what has the belief done for you lately? You know, here we believe that we exist. Has that made your life easier?
I don't know if it made it easier, but it's the opposite. Well, maybe I'm turning a non-belief into a belief too.
Ah, another of Saraha's warnings. He who believes in reality is stupid, like a cow. Or he who believes in a self is stupid like a cow. But he who believes in non-self is even stupider. It's not about belief. Okay? And, yeah, it sounds quite radical. Well, Buddhism is radical, number one. But I think if you examine your own experience, you will see that beliefs are... One of the effects of beliefs is they prevent you from seeing what actually is. We come in... I had a very vivid experience of this Rinpoche asked me to stay with the Lama he left in Vancouver in the early 70s, and we were invited up to the Yukon. And so he flew up there, and there was a small Dharma center up there, and went to bed, and it was early summer, and we weren't up in the Arctic Circle. We were about 300 miles from it, but it was still, you know, like 10 or 11 at night. It was barely twilight. You could see quite happily. And next, I went off because I knew a couple of people up there, and we drove around and did some things and came back. And next morning, the Lama said, "Ken, yeah? I didn't get dark last night. What's going on?" And he was really worried. And I said, "Well, that's how it is up at this latitude. It's no big deal." And he went, "What do you mean?" So I got out oranges and apples and showed him the whole astronomy bit. And he went, "Oh. You know, we'd always heard this business about the world being round, but none of us ever believed it. And this is the first thing that actually started to affect that belief." So, beliefs get in the way. They prevent us from seeing what is. Because when we are functioning under belief, we are bringing a whole set of assumptions to the situation. Maybe they hold. Maybe they don't. What if you brought no beliefs to the situation? What would that be like? So I'm going to give you a little extra exercise. Just for you. You live by yourself? Family? Good. You going to have breakfast with them tomorrow?
Probably not.
Going to have any interaction with them? Or are they in another town? Yes. Okay. I want you to approach that interaction and let go of every belief that you have and tell me what your experience is. It's just a little exercise. You know. About who your wife or your children or whoever you is. Let go of any belief and just approach it totally new. Tell me what your experience is, okay? Right. You had a question?
Well, you know, you say that Buddhism is a radical.
I think so. No, that's just a description.
But, well, it feels like it's Buddhism.
No, it's...
Because it's the opposite. I mean, why is it radical? It has to be radical in comparison to something else.
Exactly, it's a description. It's, do I believe it's radical? No, compared to other things, it's... looks radical, that's all. I mean, from my point of view, and one of the reasons I got into Buddhism is it just made sense. Like, oh. And the more I've studied and practiced it, the more sense it's made. It's quite different from the sense that I originally thought it did. That was, and I mean, it's been my own experience and practice that it's a case of stripping away one layer of belief after another. And,
all I'm saying is still thinking very language. And I'm not disputing your point. I agree with you. What I'm saying is that when you talk, not you, anybody, when anybody still thinks the language, it says something.
Oh, I think we can use language more intelligently than that.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll try. Yeah. We'll try. Okay. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment on language also, how easily one could take the the anecdote you gave about believing that the world was flat and then realizing that it is not, still people would say, I believe the world is round.
Oh, yes.
And then say, I experience or I observe.
It does. And actually, we can even go further than that. We believe that there's a world out there. No? Is there?
Is that a rhetorical question?
No.
Well, there's the experience of a world existing.
An experience, I'm going to suggest, which is based on a belief.
Well, that's fine.
That's right here. Okay, we'll explore it. Good. Yes.
Suppose that we look around us in the world and we see the seemingly great majority of people have a kind of blind belief of what kind of seem to operate basically upon that.
Yes.
And so if a person nurtures her or himself to see clearly without resting that on belief, doesn't that put one at great odds with virtually everybody in the world?
So?
In a very disruptive manner, unless you do not check the belief.
Well, what's the problem?
In other words, shut up and just...
No.
No.
I think this is where skillful means comes in. Skillful means. Buddha, after his enlightenment, said to himself, no one's going to understand this. That's just exactly what he's saying. What can I do with it? Nobody's going to understand this. And said, I'm not going to tell anybody. And then, according to the myths, the gods appeared before him and said, no. You've got this great, wonderful understanding. It can change the lives of countless beings throughout the course of history. You got to tell somebody. And he went, okay, I'll try. And the rest is history. Now, does it take skill? Absolutely. One of the things that I really like about Buddhism, don't talk to people who aren't interested. There has to be a volition, a willingness. People have to be questioning themselves. And they have a sense that something's not right here. And that arouses some curiosity. And that curiosity is an opening. But, yeah, you're quite right. The vast majority of people function under a certain set of beliefs about who they are and how the world is. And we've had, 5, 10,000 years of warfare and inequity and suffering and disease, etc., etc., etc. And that's how the world is. And we also have the extraordinary opportunity to come in touch with these teachings, which really cut right through all of this. Some mystery has brought us to this. That's quite wonderful. And what we do with it is really up to us. And where we go, if we practice and come to some kind of understanding, then what we do with that understanding is very much up to us. And it's going to vary from person to person. It takes many, many different forms. I think it was Ikkyu, the Zen master, when he completed his training, his own teacher said to him, "I've had a vision that you are to go to such and such a mountain and establish a monastery of 2,500 monks." Nikyo said, "That's nice." "Well," the teacher said, "it's time for you to leave. You've completed your training." So he left, and he went to that mountain, and he sat down. After a while, some villagers came and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm sitting here," and they talked. 15-20 years later, there is a monastery of 2,500 monks. You follow? Okay, one more question before we close, if there is one. If not, we can close here. Okay, thank you very much. See you tomorrow.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.